Well, welcome to Who's Talking. This is DG Martin, the most favorite guest on Who's Talking for all times. Gosh, you wouldn't believe it. In Chapel Hill, Carrboro, with a big liberal wind blowing, the favorite guest for Who's Talking doesn't blow in that direction. And it's Bernie Rees, the editor and publisher, or the publisher and editor of Raleigh's Metro Magazine. And Bernie, I hate to say it, I hate to admit it, but when you're on, I get more comments, and they're favorable. Not always about you and not always about me, right. But they like what's going on.
Well, because we're more topical, but when I get to Chapel Hill, I always, you know, they kill people that look like me in Chapel Hill.
Well, so do they stop you when you come in Chapel Hill?
No, Durham maybe, but not Chapel Hill.
Why is it? Why is
Chapel Hill's always been a favorite. I think Chapel Hill's an intellectual community that covers a lot of ground. I think a lot of people hide their true feelings because of fear of retribution by the social circuit here, but otherwise, Chapel Hill's just fine with me. We do quite well with Spectator, Triangle Business, and now Metro.
Yeah, Metro, you show no, I would say almost you tilt towards boosting Chapel Hill's art scene, its dining scene, and the kinds of things that are here for entertainment.
Well, I earned my spurs, you know, with the Spectator. I mean, we were the first to bring all that together, and Chapel Hill always in Durham, I have to say Durham, have many of the finest, all sorts of things, not just entertainment restaurants, but I mean the Wilson Library is here, the North Carolina Collections here, the Politics of University Life are here. So, yeah, I mean.
Well, Carrboro has developed a reputation not just of the Paris of the Piedmont, but it's also a place where music groups get started and thrive. And why is that?
Well, because of the university environment. I mean, I grew up in Raleigh, which was a university town, too, people forget. And when you're, you know, places like the Players Retreat or Fraternity Houses playing the original Embers back in 1959, all that comes from university towns, not from other types of cities. So I think we're very fortunate here.
Well, recently I heard on this radio station that Carrboro was possibly in trouble because there's a proposal to withdraw funding, federal funding from cities and towns, which had declared themselves to be cities of refuge. That is, that they would not enforce the federal immigration policy. They wouldn't arrest and would give sanctuary to illegal immigrants. And so when I heard that, and I remembered about how much you love Carrboro and the music scene, I just wondered whether or not you would be supportive of Carrboro or the federal government's withdrawal of federal aid to a town that's just trying to do good. How do you come down on that?
Look, sometimes I'm outraged at things, but mostly I'm tolerant, and I get a kick out of people, you know, doing their own thing. And I like to live in a country where people are allowed to do their own thing, no matter where their political influence comes from. So I think that's just fine. But I don't think that it's in sync with the national psyche, which is fine. And that's
well,
what you want.
What is the national psyche?
Well, funny, Katie, my wife, that you know, had me watch a new show hosted by Drew Carey called The Power of Ten. It's kind of like a remake of Family Feud, but it's not. But they ask people questions based on national polls, like how many Americans this or that. And one of the questions last night was how many Americans think all immigrants should speak fluent English before becoming citizens? What do you think the percentage was in a national poll?
76.
Right. So
is it exactly?
Exactly. Well, 70, above 70. I can't remember. I think it was 71. But the point I'm trying to make is often media, intellectual community are out of sync with the feelings of the real people, and that's the tension of the political environment in this country. I mean, I don't think that's so bad, except when the media, intellectual community impose their views beyond the tolerance of the rest of us. And that's a funny line where that falls, you know?
All right, well, let me ask you another question. Right here in WCHL Studios, right next door, is David Price's... you know, one of his community offices, and a group gathered to protest or to present a petition to Representative Price urging him to lead the impeachment effort against President Bush. And I said, golly, I wish Bernie could have coordinated his visit so he could have participated in that. And how do you come down
on
that?
Well, I have written this and gotten a lot of comment. I think that the landscape changed in 2000 in Florida. It seems like that the a civil war was declared between the two parties, and that the civility of political discourse was dropped in the favor of total scorched earth political policy. And, you know, this whole business of the new Democrat majority in the Congress, I said, well, that's just fine, because they can make total fools of themselves, which is pretty much what they've done, like having an all-night pillow fight, you know, to try to get Bush to pull out of Iraq, and then failing, and then watching, and then, of course, Nancy Pelosi visiting Syria, and thinking that they're somehow in the vanguard. And then what happens is that the political polls show that the approval ratings of Congress are now below George Bush's approval rating. So that kind of stuff, trying to get David Price to do this or that and impeach George Bush, are all part of the zany righteousness of a certain people that just doesn't resonate.
Well, it's interesting to me that Nancy Pelosi has a rival now because she will not lead the impeachment effort. In other words, that these people who you
impeach
would categorize as
what?
Beat is
impeach for what? I mean, DG, this is just all political rhetoric. I mean, for God's sake, I'd rather not talk about something as ridiculous as that.
Why is it ridiculous?
Because why would you impeach George Bush? Well, what kind of high crimes and misdemeanors?
Well, for violating the United States Constitution, taking us to war, you know, without...
I refuse to lower myself to discuss that. There is no precedent, evidence, or reason to use those kinds of terms, which makes me worry about you now. I mean, whatever happened...
I want you to be worried about me.
Yeah, but, you know, DG, whatever happened to... As I say, you know, civil discourse in politics.
Well, the great thing about you is that I can have a civil discourse with you about things that other people might think are outrageous, but there is a case to be made in terms of the president's manipulation and deception in terms of taking us to war that merits a full disclosure. Why won't you? I mean, guys, you who are listening, you can't.
Reason that I shan't respond is that it failed. And it failed because there wasn't enough traction. And there wasn't enough traction because those in the Congress who took on that kind of attitude found out that their constituency didn't support it. It's like the war. I mean, you know, I know David Price's office reminds me that there was some kind of big rally about pulling out of the war, I think, that Price's office a couple of years ago. And, you know, they just can't get traction there either. I mean, people are hardly in the streets. This is a volunteer army that wants to go fight. They're just having trouble using 60s tactics in a modern millennial police action, which is what it is, in Iraq, DG. I mean, just to dwell on that for a second, when I get in these arguments about the war in Iraq, you know, first of all, I support George Bush. I mean, this is something that drives people nuts.
Yeah,
I'm sure it will in Chapel Hill.
Yeah.
And I will not go into defending
we won't
that.
Broadcast this program until you're safely out of town.
Well, no, but I happen to support him. And if somebody said they didn't, I wouldn't want to, you know, come and burn crosses in their yard. Now, I assume they don't want to do it to me. But I think it is important that everyone understand that, for instance, if there's no demonstration against the fact that we've had between 200,000 and 500,000 troops in Europe since 1945. We've got 90,000 troops in Korea. We guarantee the security of Japan. When Bill Clinton, you know, sent troops into the Balkans and the Kosovo because the European community couldn't handle the problem, we still rotate troops in the Balkans on an hourly basis. We are everywhere because we are de facto the imperial power of the modern age, you know, the British Empire of the new millennium. And I'm not saying that's good. I happen to think it's fine because I think you need that. But to keep the world stable. But America's role is something we don't want to admit. And I think that leads to this faulty thinking about whether we're in Iraq or whether we're here or whether we're there. I mean, what do you think? Should we go to Mogadishu? I mean, well, where are you going to decide? And let me tell you something. We live in a complicated, very interconnected, high-tech, satellite-driven, laser-driven world. Wait a minute now. And let me tell you, and you know from my spy conference that I have some concept of what goes on. And I can assure you that it is a far, if all George Bush has to do is put his arm around Nancy Pelosi and take her in the Situation Room and say, let me show you what's going on. 99% of which I can't communicate to the American people. I have to sit here and take it. And the lack of understanding by the opposition of what goes on to run an empire, amazes me. It's naive, it's ignorant, and that's what I object to, not necessarily their feelings.
We got to take a breath. Take a break so Bernie can take voice. No, so you can take a break. Catch your breath and I can get my voice back so I can interrupt you.
I know.
Bernie Reason, I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Bernie Reeves, who's the publisher and editor of Metro Magazine. And he and I agree on almost everything, as those of you who've been listening understand. And Bernie was explaining to me why, instead of gathering with the crowd that gathered at Representative Price's office recently to urge the impeachment of President Bush, I ought to be joining Bernie Reeves and his colleagues in supporting the president in continuing our military presence in Iraq for as long as it takes.
Well, you pick out the military presence in Iraq. You know,
Was I wrong to do that?
No, but I would submit this to you, that if Iraq, I mean, the 9/11 attack was the equivalent of the Pearl Harbor attack. I mean, in the sense of the bookends of the only attacks on the United States. If you're the president, you've got to do something. And George Bush decided to do something. He chose Iraq. He had to draw the line in the sand, figuratively or literally, somewhere. And I think he chose Iraq above all the others in Afghanistan. And I think that that's all part of what's going on. You remember the criticism? Well, what do you mean we're going to Iraq? Al-Qaeda's not in Iraq. Well, now on the news every day, unashamedly, NPR reports that, you know, we fought Al-Qaeda today. I think that we are bringing the battle home. And it's a sickening and horrible carnage.
We were able to go into Iraq and then where there was no Al-Qaeda and draw them into Iraq where we could shoot them.
Which is really what George Bush said in 2003, and everybody laughed at him.
And you support, now again, I think that you're promoting two different ideas. I want to be sure that
I'm trying to put Iraq in context of the war on terror, and I think that George Bush is doing that. And you know, you don't always agree, or you don't, he's not always right about everything, but I think he is sticking to his mission, kind of like Reagan did.
Public support evaporating?
Well, because the media churn up a constant anti-war rhetoric and now, of course, the media are being held up for a lot more scrutiny than they've ever had before. You know, watching the News and Observer rearrange the deck chairs on their Titanic is a great pleasure to me.
Yeah, well, I do want to talk about...
They don't have any credibility.
I want to talk about that.
So therefore, they have stirred it all up, and they keep polling people who they feed their own news lines to.
It's your theory that it is the media which is driving the public away from the support for the war rather than the media being responsive to a dwindling support by the public, you know, for year after year after year of troop losses and no real immediate prospect of any kind of success there. You know, it's longer than World War II. You know, it's a long, long presence here. This is longer than anything we've been involved in, isn't it?
Well, I mean, they obviously got you. When people start taking on these kinds of issues as righteous religious conviction, it doesn't do me any good to try to put it into an objective, factual context.
No, well,
nobody wants to listen to me.
Well, let's argue about it or discuss it.
Every time I break. I mean, as soon as I bring it up, people fall into the catechism. I mean, they just start into this righteousness stuff, and I don't care about all that.
I'll back away.
Look, I'm a history major.
No, well, let's
UNC,
talk about it.
UNC.
Let's talk about it. And
that's made me different as an editor and publisher. I'm surviving.
Let's stay on the topic for just a moment on the basis on which you say you would not mind discussing it, and that's on facts and non-religious bases and on the facts. What is the objective that the president has put forth with respect to our presence in Iraq and continuing indefinitely that leads you to say this is really important for you know that we line them up. You and I can do this. We can line up the positives and the negatives on each side and then weigh them, can't we? Couldn't we do that?
Well, we can, but we're probably missing half the data. But let's do this. Let's just review recent. That's what amazes me is that where is everybody when all this stuff comes down? I mean, the Congress that was elected totally focused itself on pulling us out of Iraq. And they didn't get any traction. It didn't happen. They couldn't even get their own colleagues to pass a resolution to pull out of Iraq. They couldn't get their constituency at home to run outside with placards. They just didn't happen. So why are we rehashing it? You're forgetting that the way we work is a representative democracy. This went on. Your people went to work. And they made it an absolute full-scale war against Bush and Iraq. Well, man, and Iraq. And what happened? How about the all-night pillow fight? How about all these resolutions
well,
that didn't
I
pass?
I thought you wanted to discuss this on the basis of facts rather than
well,
rhetoric,
do,
and all
but
you're
the,
going in is to talk about...
But the facts are, though, that this crowd of people was unsuccessful.
Right, but...
And that's a fact.
But I just wanted to say that you... But that fact has
that,
nothing to do with... You're going back to some kind of religious, argumentative rhetoric kind of stuff rather than focusing on the thing that you said you wanted to.
I can do that.
Well, do it. Prove to me. You say you'd like to do this, but you've never done it. So do it
this
one time.
I said, I mean,
instead of talking about what happened in Congress and some, you know, some pillow fight or something like that.
You know, DG should stand for disingenuous.
It does.
Disingenuous,
it does.
Martin. Because, you know, you listen to selectively, and then you ask selectively, and then you believe ecstatically. And so somehow it's difficult for somebody,
gosh, thank you.
You know, for somebody to respond. I did try to do that. Let's go back.
Try again. Do it on facts. Focus on Iraq. Focus on the United States Army and Armed Forces.
Right, you are the President of the United States, and the 9/11 occurs. It's almost like Roosevelt and the Doolittle raid. We had to do something. George Bush chose, when he got up and said to the nation that we've identified 60 countries where there's enough negative Muslim terrorist activity that we need to be aware of. And therefore, you know, we're going to fight it. He said, we're going to fight it everywhere we can for the safety and security of the world. And, of course, he couldn't go into 60 countries. He chose one and two countries where most of it was happening, Afghanistan and Iraq. And I think that that was a strategy that was acceptable. I think that we brought up the point about drawing al-Qaeda has occurred, which was laughed at back then. I'm giving you the facts here. And that we deployed our services maybe effectively, maybe ineffectively. And I think the ineffectiveness under Rumsfeld comes from the other issue we brought up is the inability of Americans to recognize our imperial role in the world. You know, we just don't want to admit it. That's why I went through the litany of explaining where we have troops already. I mean, nobody's in the street saying, why do we have troops in Germany, France, and Italy, and now Hungary and Poland and Romania? You know, why do we have troops in Kosovo and rotating new forces there all the time? And why do we protect Korea? You know, what I'm driving at is that when you have a political environment in which you have an unpopular president, not an unpopular president, but a president the left doesn't know the Democrats don't like, they make this particular part of the war a bigger thing than I think it is in the larger scheme of America's imperial responsibilities. That's what I say. I think that everybody came to the conclusion that whether it's the congressperson Pelosi or whether it's a candidate like Hillary Clinton, we can't pull out.
Did you support Bosnia, by the way? Did you support the presence of American troops in Yugoslavia?
Sure, I did. And one reason
all
I did
the, all the troops, and you support the in Somalia, Mogadishu, you supported the troops then?
I'm not certain because I do have an aversion to African operations because I think that they are really going into a civilization situation that is hopeless. You know, I would like to see African countries regain their former relationships with colonial powers.
Ooh, let's take a break. It's time to take a break. I can't respond to that. I'm talking to Bernie Reese. Man, isn't he great? And we'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is the all-wise, all-knowing Bernie Reeves, editor and publisher and editor of Raleigh's Metro Magazine.
The Triangles.
Metro. The Triangles and the Coast. And,
right.
And the Coast.
Triangle to the Coast.
Well, listen, Bernie, I've been exploiting you to get you to talk about things that are provocative here in Chapel Hill. And what one thing I love about you is that you're not afraid to challenge the conventional wisdom here in Chapel Hill, even if in challenging it, you show yourself to be not well grounded on the facts or on the rationale or the reasoning.
I'm well grounded in the facts, DJ.
No,
I'm just not connected to the emotion.
You're just not connected.
Well, let's extend that conversation about America's
imperial
role.
Would you rather do that, or would you rather talk? One of the great things that you do every year is to you're the founder of what we call the Raleigh International Spy Conference, and I love to talk about. You and I agree on one thing, but whether it's just because, I don't know why it is, but I mean, when I was in the Army, I was in counterintelligence, and I aspired to be, to stop the spies. That was sort of what my business was. And we learned all of these tricks, and now I find out that what we learned was just sort of, first grade stuff.
Rudimentary compared to now, yeah.
It was just nothing.
Did you watch The Company?
I did watch The Company, and I wanted to, for those of you who didn't watch The Company, it was a cable series. It was on recently, a three-part series on Sunday evenings, which was a fictionalization based on a novel, but loosely based upon the CIA and its history from World War II until the recent presence. And Bernie, you asked this question, and I'm the thing that... I'm all loaded with questions for you about The Company because the anti-hero or the hero of this story was a guy named James Angleton, who was a part of the CIA, and they portrayed him both as, one of the weirdest, most roughest, kind of a bad boy in the CIA, directed it, and then at the end, turned out he was a hero. Now, I had an interest in him because his son sort of served with me down at Fort Bragg. In the Special Forces or in the Special Warfare Center down at Fort Bragg. And so we sort of knew who his daddy was. I didn't really know why his daddy was famous until then. So here's since you raised the question about The Company in the context of the spy company, and since you are acknowledged, even by me, to be the expert about spies and spying and where we are.
Well, intelligence,
intelligence and counterintelligence. What about The Company? I mean, this was a disturbing presentation of our CIA. Was it loosely, at least, based on fact?
In fact, I had an email response this morning from my friend Brian Kelly, who showed up at our, as one of the major players in our first spy conference, the man that the FBI was convinced was actually who turned out to be Robert Hansen. And Kelly was a CIA counterintelligence guy, and his life was ruined and then resurrected, but because of his paranoia, came same kind of thing. But Kelly liked The Company, and I liked it, and you liked it. He thought it was fair. I thought it was fair, except for the last scene in which the two main characters discuss get into the famous moral equivalency conversation, which, of course, you can always trot out professors in the 70s about how great a system the Soviet Union was. It's reminding me of that. But the character was the composite character, Jack McAuliffe.
Let me interrupt real quickly just to put this in context, because for those of you who didn't see The Company, when it's rebroadcast, watch it because it's fascinating. Yeah. But it's
good.
Basically,
it's damn good.
It's 3 hours, and you get to see...
No, it's 3 2-hour episodes.
You're absolutely right about that. 3 2-hour episodes, and what it does is to take two spies, I guess, two employees of the... intelligence services, one of the CIA and then one of the Soviet spy services, and follow them as they conduct their intelligence gathering and counterintelligence activities, and you get to have an identification with each of them.
That observation is somewhat accurate, but the balance between Eugene, who was the Soviet KGB recruit, and our hero McAuliffe, where it was a little out of balance because it really was a CIA story. What I liked about what the author did is, because I'm not very good at writing fiction, I don't understand how to write fiction, but he did a great job of that. Our hero showed up first in Berlin, you know, in 55 or so, when it was rough. I mean, with the, you know, the Cold War was really, really at work. Then he shows up in Hungary during the uprising. That was as well depicted dramatically as anything I've ever seen. I keep telling my friend Godfrey Cheshire, the movie maker, you know, with,
yeah,
you know, the good stuff's happening on TV, Godfrey. I mean, this is really, Ridley Scott, you know, was the producer of this. I mean, it was so finely done. You know, I have a connection to that. My New Zealand mother's uncle, my great uncle, was president of the United Nations General Assembly during the Hungarian crisis and resigned over the lack of response by the West. But leave that aside. It's my first kind of awareness. I remember being put down in front of the TV when I was 9 years old. You know, Sir Leslie's resigning over Hungary. So, you know, maybe that's why I'm a Cold Warrior today. But the point is, then our man shows up in Cuba at the Bay of Pigs. And the one place he didn't show up that I thought was interesting in the way they did this was Vietnam. And I think that brings up an interesting disinformation thing. You remember that, you know, from Hare and all that, the dirty little war, the CIA war in Vietnam. Well, now it's come out that it wasn't the CIA recommended against going into Vietnam, but yet they were saddled by the left, which I think got most of its information from KGB disinformation, and the CIA got staying with Vietnam. Now, they did do operations there, don't get me wrong, but they did not want to go there. That's now come out. But they did. But they left Vietnam out of this. But the reason I liked this so much is that it ties into the spy conference. You remember that they found the mole, and they tortured him and all that.
And we're talking about the recent cable broadcast of The Company, loosely based on the CIA.
Right, and a lot of the plot had to do with the Angleton angle is based on a mole within CIA, which was a recurring theme all during Angleton's career as head of counterintelligence. And he became convinced that there was a major Soviet mole inside CIA. And the irony that occurred was that he became friends with, and they all were friends with, and the company overdoes this, I will say that, with the most famous arch spy of the whole era, Kim Philby. You know, and you know, then Philby's exposed as a Soviet agent, and Angleton, who was his friend, is made to look stupid in there. But all that being said,
is that accurate? Is that accurate?
But not the close
exaggerated,
friendship.
And not the real close
See,
friendship.
Philby had worked himself up to be the liaison between British Secret Service, MI6. And American
CIA. So he knew
CIA.
Everything.
He knew everything.
It was going on both places.
Right. And Angleton, of course, was in company with Philby, as they all were. I think the film, The Company, overblew that to make Angleton look bad. But then again, they resurrected Angleton later. Anyway, the point I'm trying to drive at is that there's a parallel to the guy, that mole they found, with our spy conference. And it's a great story. And I urge people to go to www.metronc.com and read my August column called Spy Wars, because we're going to have a real humdinger coming up in March. We've postponed it from August to March over the something related to this.
Just to put this in context, this will be March 08.
08.
Okay, let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and learn more about the upcoming March 2008 Raleigh International Spy Conference from its founder and organizer, Bernie Reeves. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Bernie Reeves, the publisher and editor of Metro Magazine and the founder of the Raleigh International Spy Conference. We persuaded him to tell us a little bit about the spy conference. And I have to apologize to those of you who are having to listen to our conversation about The Company. This 6-hour, well, really 3 nights of 2 hours that we've seen recently on cable television, and will certainly be rebroadcast.
And you can buy the DVD, I'm sure, which would be great. You can watch it straight through.
Yeah, but it a great story, and Bernie and I are talking about that. If you haven't seen it, we apologize for the insider talk about that, but it is real important in the context of what really happened. On all of these things, I want to know what's really... Now, Bernie, tell us more about what's coming up in this
But segueing off of the company, there's a whole major part of the drama in the last episode was the interrogation and torture of one of CIA's own people to see if he was indeed the famous mole that James Jesus Angleton, you know, had thought was within CIA in the company, in the production. He was indeed that person. But there's another famous interrogation that has come up, and let me tell it to you quickly and briefly because people will like this. On Capitol Square in Raleigh, which is really called Union Square, there is a statue to Worth Bagley. Worth Bagley was the first American killed in the Spanish-American War. His sister, Mary Josephus Daniels, of the newspaper family, so they're all related. But a nephew of the same Worth Bagley was CIA, and his name was Pete Bagley. And Pete Bagley happened to be in Vienna in 1964 when a KGB officer named Yuri Novosinko said, I'm sure there are people listening out there, because Chapel Hill is full of retired spies, so they'll love this. Yuri Novosinko showed up. He had been working for us, you know, within Russia, you know, and all of a sudden he said, in 2 years later, I want to defect. And the person who handled this case was Pete Bagley. And they said, well, that's great, you know. And whereupon Novosinko said, by the way, we had nothing to do with the assassination of JFK. And then Novosinko said, we had no contact with Oswald when he lived in Russia for almost 3 years. Well, immediately Bagley is suspicious of Nosenko's defection, and why would he do that? But he didn't let that drive him entirely. But he then began the interrogation to verify what they call the bona fides, you know, of Novosinko. Well, tell me where you were and this and that and dates and everything, which is kind of like the company did, you know, when they interrogated Kritsky. Well, the upshot of it was that nothing ever with Novosinko seemed to fit. I mean, he said he was a colonel in the KGB. Now he was a captain. He said he was in, you know, Finland in 1966, but now he was in Italy. I mean, it kept going like that, and Angleton got involved, which is a big deal. And finally, after 2 years of this friendly kind of but harsh interrogation, Bagley and Angleton and others, actually there was another person involved in this, locked him up, Novosinko, in a stockade in Virginia in a prison, confinement, where he couldn't have, you know, fun, and then subjected him to 3 years of this, maybe more. Well, by all that time, nothing ever came out of Novosinko that anybody could, you know, trust. Bagley went on to other assignments and then retired later. Of course, Angleton retired, as you know. And then Novosinko, all of a sudden, is made a hero by the new director, William Colby. All of a sudden, because Novosinko represented a victim of what they saw as Angleton's paranoia about a mole, even though he wasn't a mole, he was a defector, but it's the same attitude. They used Novosinko as the call celeb, you know, to go after what they thought Angleton had done to destroy the agency. So Novosinko suddenly is resurrected into being a speaker at Langley. I mean, he goes and he's now a big hero and a big friend of everybody. Bagley then retires to Brussels, our friend Bagley, who first handled Novosinko. And then in the last March, a book came out by Bagley at age 82, revisiting the whole thing, because in the meantime, the Soviet Union had collapsed. In the meantime, new documents had been declassified, which is all part of the Raleigh spy conference, as you know. Whereupon, he went and talked to KGB people that were on the other side.
And what did he find out?
And he found out that Novosinko was a liar.
Well,
here's the story, and I'll end it. I got wind of this, read the book, very tedious, but I read it, you know, and Novosinko is interesting to me because it puts intelligence fingerprints on the Kennedy assassination and Oswald, okay? That's always a sexy thing. Whereupon, though, Bagley was going to speak on his book at CIA at the end of June. And my wife and I went up, met with our CIA friends up there for dinner. And then we find out that the talk was abruptly canceled. Humiliating Bagley. I mean, this never happened. The guy wrote a legitimate book.
Who sponsored it and who canceled it?
Well, CIA had... CIA, the agency itself, had him scheduled for a Thursday morning at Langley. We were going to a 12 o'clock rendition at the Spy Museum, but canceled both of them. I mean, the CIA humiliated, embarrassed, and literally, you know,
so
censored.
Why don't you bring Bagley back to the Spy Conference?
That's what I'm doing.
I should have known. You sucked me in. So you're going to have him in March.
And now that was a big deal. It's a big deal.
And so he'll now disclose and talk.
Right. He'll be here. He'll be the keynote speaker coming over from Brussels. Took me a lot to do this. Meanwhile, Brian Kelly's got involved. We've got the expert, the chief historian at CIA named Robar. Dave Robarge has agreed today to come to do everything you ever wanted to know about Angleton.
Oh, my golly. You're kidding me.
No. And then we've got David Ignatius, the Washington
Post. All right. Now, you just sucked me in.
It's going to be unbelievable.
I'm deeply embarrassed that I've been manipulated by you.
We're going to have Nisenko, Oswald, JFK, Angleton. It's almost going to be like Unsolved Mysteries of the CIA.
Well, let me ask you this.
It's going to be a humdinger.
I want to get
March 26th.
March 26th.
RaleighSpyConference.com.
But before, we were just about out of time, but let me get back to the company, which was this cable... Fictionalized history of the CIA.
Excellent, excellent production.
And part of it dealt with the attempted assassination of Fidel Castro, using mafia connections. Mm-hmm. And I was totally shocked by all of this and wanted to ask Bernie Rees right there on the spot, is this fiction or is this
sort of
the way it happened?
Yeah, I'll tell you how I know that if we have time.
Tell us the story.
Quickly, okay. I'll tell you that I got involved in this. But let me tell you how. But the way to tell the story is that in 76, the Senate convened the Senate Intelligence Committee under Frank Church because of connections with the intelligence agency to the Watergate break-in. And while they were there, that's when William Colby gave them the family jewels that they keep talking about today that were re-released, you know, a month ago. In it, though, the CIA Colbys let the Congress know that the CIA contracted with the mafia to try to assassinate Castro. True story. Now, the reason that's interesting on the JFK angle is that the Warren Commission did not have this information, which would have been major evidence of somebody with a motive to kill Kennedy. And that led to a whole resurrection of the conspiracy theories once more. I mean, whatever the hell else was the CIA doing back then, and so forth. So yes, indeed, in the way they depicted that was probably a true story. They did try to kill Castro, and they did hire the mafia to do it, because the mafia had an interest in getting their casinos back. But, yeah, that is true. Now, the Raleigh thing we got involved in is that Lee Harvey Oswald tried to call Raleigh, North Carolina, from the jail, Dallas jail. And we found that out in 1980. We had an international exclusive.
Why do we think he did that?
Well, I can tell you that if you want me to tell you that.
I do.
Now.
Yes.
Well, I always like to tell it this way, and first of all, you've got the church committee in 76, and you find out that there are all these things going on. You go back to 63, and a piece of information that was lying around that nobody did anything with for a long time until 1980, when a British writer came over and kind of saw things at a distance and pulled together all this flotsam and jetsam of conspiracy theories and data and wrote a book called Conspiracy, which is a really good book. His name is David Summers. And I saw a galley proof of the book. Somebody got through the New York Review of Books.
I do have to hurry you along now.
And I found out that he was writing about a call to Raleigh. I said, what is this? That's Raleigh. So we kind of got it first and wrote it up, and we interviewed all these people, including Victor Marchetti, who's not supposed to be talking, and all these strange people. Our phones were tapped, et cetera, et cetera. The upshot of it was that we wrote these articles, and I actually had to go to the News and Observer and yell, stop the presses, because they were trying to steal my story. This is in 1980. Here's the story. Oswald leaves the depository, goes to his rooming house, walks down the street, and shoots Officer J.D. Tippit. When he then runs into Texas Theater, they arrest him for the murder of Tippit. Not until later in the evening do they get around to charging him with the murder of Kennedy. And so in the evening, the switchboard operator, the old-time plug-in switchboard operator, was going off duty. Another woman was coming on duty, and they're sitting there, and in comes a government man, as they said, who said to them, Mr. Oswald's getting ready to make a call. about 10 o'clock at night, that night of the killing.
So it is one call, or is this, well, I got to hurry you. Don't let me interrupt you. Keep going.
Mr. Oswald's going to make a call. That's all they knew. And so they both stayed there. And sure enough, they lit up. They plugged in, one of them did. And of course, she had to write down the number and then call long distance to reconnect him. So that she wrote it down, went into the next room to give the government man the note. And he said, tell Mr. Oswald his call didn't go through. Well, she saved the slip of paper. And in all of the stuff about the assassination and all the conspiracy theory, nobody knew what to do with this call. They just let it sit there until 1980. And then we find out that it was not an incoming call, as somebody said. It was indeed an outgoing call. And yes, the slip of paper is real. And yes, Oswald tried to call a number in Raleigh. So we called that number, and we got a guy named John Hurt. And the upshot of it is this. What's going on? It looks as if John Hurt was a fake cutout. A cutout, is a middleman that you, if you're an ops agent, as you were, you have to call. You don't call home. You call, like, 3 days of the Condor.
Hurry, we're almost out of time.
So the intelligence connection is here. It looks as if Oswald thought he was working for the good guys and an intelligence op to kill Kennedy. If that was so, he would know that he would have a cutout, and they gave him a cutout. It was a fake cutout. When he made that phone call to that cutout that night, the next morning he was dead.
Wow. Oh, my gosh, we're out of town. You'll just have to come back. We'll have Bernie Reese back very soon to continue his discussion of the spy conference, and maybe we can also get him warmed up on some of these issues on which he and I disagree. Bernie, thanks a lot for visiting.
Pleasure.
Look forward to having you back soon, and hope all of y'all will tune in same time tomorrow for Who's Talking.